I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Cohen and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Mort Rosenblum, famed AP reporter, former editor of the International Herald Tribune, and author of 13 books on the changing state of the media today. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Cohen and Two Jewish.
Shalom. A little over a week ago, Bernie Sanders came to Tucson, Arizona, where I live, and spoke at our convention center. Now, we don't get so many presidential candidates showing up in our city of a million people here in the Sonoran Desert very often, so lots of folks went to see him, especially Jews who wanted to see or have their children see the most successful Jewish candidate for president of the United States in history so far. Unfortunately, Bernie Sanders spoke here on a Friday night, so I began my Shabbat evening services at our Temple Emmanuel by saying, I appreciate you all being here, where Bernie Sanders should actually be in Shul, where Jews belong on Shabbat. It got a laugh. Along the same lines, I also made the mistake of watching some political ads last week, which were airing here while the Arizona primary election for president was going on. The startling thing about watching these political ads was that sometimes you weren't sure if the person was running for president or trying to get his own show on God TV. There were candidates praying, speaking in front of religious symbols, trumpeting their religious convictions, practices, and beliefs loudly and proudly. It was slightly disturbing. As a rabbi and religious leader myself, I certainly value religion as the foundation of society, and believe that the ethics that underlie our legal system originated from religious ideas and ideals and morality. America remains the most religiously oriented, developed country in the world, with far higher rates of affiliation and church and synagogue attendance than European or Asian countries with comparable standards of living. Generally speaking, I think that's a good thing. But I do not vote for a president of the United States based on whether he or she prays the most or worships in the right pews on the right day of the week. And frankly, I don't think anyone else should either. I do want rabbis, ministers, priests, and imams to be religiously dedicated and motivated. But I could care less just how religious our political leadership is. There have been presidents who were deeply religious, good men, who were terrible presidents. Jimmy Carter comes to mind. And there have been presidents who were deeply religious, good men, who were great presidents, like George Washington. There have been non-religious, good men who were great presidents, like Abraham Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt. And there have been non-religious, bad men, like Richard Nixon or Warren Harding, who were lousy presidents. Religion has very, very little to do with whether someone is qualified to be president or will do a good job. And I find it preposterous that people will actually vote for a presidential candidate based on his or her presentations of piety. I don't care if my president goes to church or synagogue or mosque or temple regularly or not. I don't care if he or she prays regularly, consults God for important policy decisions, or has a pastor, priest, rabbi, or monk who comes to the Oval Office to talk religion and ethical questions. What I care about is if the president can govern, make good decisions, have a vision for domestic and foreign policy and execute it, and figure out a way to work with the governmental system we have in order to get good results for our country. These people are not running for minister or senior rabbi. They are running for president. Candidates, please leave the religious remarks and imagery to those of us who do this professionally. play us in on this beautiful spring morning. Here's the start of our pre-Passover music preview for the Festival of Freedom that's coming up in little less than a month. It's the order of the Passover Seder as sung by Yehoram Gaon in a Sephardic setting.
Maharor korech shulecha neorech tzafun barech halel niretzah. Kadesh urecha tzekarepas yachat magid rachetza motzi mahatza.
That was Yehoram Gaon, starting our pre-Pesach preview of Passover music for us here on Two Jewish with Kadesh Urechatz. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish, Mort Rosenblum, was a legendary AP reporter, nominated for 9 Pulitzer Prizes, the former editor of the International Herald Tribune, and author of 13 books. He has strong views on the changing state of media today. Find out what they are when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Hi, I'm Ben, a student at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can provide Jewish education to families at no cost to you. Direct your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, and help make great Jewish education affordable. Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. JETCO gives scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K-8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction. When you give to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income tax is reduced by the exact amount you've given. You can give up to $1,067 for a single filer and $2,134 for a married couple. You get that whole amount back from your state income tax. Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442, or go to JETCO.org. You can even choose a future date to process your payment. How cool is that? Make a tax credit contribution to JETCO and build Jewish identity in Tucson for generations of students. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Mort Rosenblum is an extraordinarily accomplished and experienced reporter, worked for the AP for many, many years, has covered stories on all the continents since the early 1960s, and we're talking about changes in the media today. Good morning and welcome, Mort.
Good morning.
So you worked for the legendary AP, which, like, what is that now?
Well, you know, the AP, we used to call it, I mean, back then the A&P food chain was going, and we used to call it the supermarket of news. After I'd been there a long time, they kind of gave me this good job to kind of sort of be in the fine food section. But essentially, its role was to cover the world, was to have people everywhere and track news as it developed. I mean, it's real easy to cover the volcano, but, you know, it's pretty hard to figure, see the lava boiling under the surface. And that's what AP was supposed to do before. And for a lot of reasons, internal and otherwise, and a lot because people think news ought to be free, the AP's kind of evolved into, like other news organizations, it relies on the big story that it can brag about, or the it's let go a lot of this essential coverage. And since everybody else has, we really don't have a clue about what's happening in many places of the world.
You know, it's extraordinary. We used to talk about papers of record. There were newspapers, there were morning papers, there were evening papers. You know, if anybody's looked at a actually printed newspaper recently, there's almost no news in it, and it's a quarter the size it was. It's happening in print journalism. It's happened on TV, too.
Well, you know, my first real job was with the Star back in the mid-60s, and back then the publisher was this kind of funny guy, a little short, red-faced guy who used to come out and scream in the newsroom, but he'd been a great foreign correspondent during World War II, and he ran a very good newspaper, and he's kept the line very clear between news and editorial, and he was fairly opinionated, as guys who own newspapers are allowed to be, but the news columns were sacrosanct, and he had some real prose reporting and some really good editors and really good foreign coverage from the AP and elsewhere, and there were a lot of newspapers. A lot of papers like that all across the country. And it's funny because I look at the numbers today and, you know, we circulated maybe 50,000 copies daily and, you know, close to 100 almost on Sunday. Well, if I look at CNN's numbers, the number of people, if you count the pass around, that used to read our stories back in the 60s in Tucson is about what CNN gets on a slow day. It's just funny. It's so fragmented that there really aren't sources of news anymore.
It is really interesting, a really different media world. We will talk much more with Mort Rosenblum when we return in just a few moments about the media today here on Too Jewish. We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes: propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from FlavorArt in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
On April 10th, the stars will be out and Vegas will come to Tucson for a charity gala at the Fox, featuring an evening with Elton, Cher, Streisand, and Midler.
For you are the wind beneath my wings, the smiles we gave to one another.
Performed by world-famous impersonators, the Edwards Twins, and emceed by our own David Fitzsimmons. Details at comedyforcharity.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We have less than 8 months until we elect a new president of the United States, and we continue our election year feature, the 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report. The AIPAC conference was in Washington, D.C. last week, the big annual meeting of the influential right-wing pro-Israel organization. All the surviving presidential candidates addressed it in person, except Bernie Sanders, who offered a video feed but was turned down. Hillary Clinton, Ted Cruz, and John Kasich all spoke to AIPAC. The biggest news was generated by, surprise, Donald Trump, who delivered a carefully prepared speech instead of his usual off-the-cuff comments. It was a somewhat measured presentation, at least for Trump, hitting all the pro-Israel notes he missed so badly when meeting with the Republican Jewish Coalition back in December. Trump played to his audience and was received with ovations by AIPAC, including during his attack on President Obama.
With President Obama in his final year, yay! He may be the worst thing to ever happen to Israel, believe me. Believe me. And you know it, and you know it better than anybody.
All of this anti-Obama stuff led the new president of AIPAC, Lillian Pincus, to make an unprecedented public apology for Trump the next morning, saying, "We say unequivocally that we do not countenance ad hominem attacks. We take great offense to those that are levied against the President of the United States of America from our stage." AIPAC, in essence, tried to distance itself from the applause its own attendees gave Trump. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about anti-Semitism in Europe, the issue that people feel about contemporary anti-Semitism. The origins of anti-Semitism in Europe we traced a little bit to anti-Judaism. You mentioned last week that that began to change at two significant points in history.
Right. And the sort of reasons and roots for anti-Semitism began to change. So the long-term goal of the church, and for, you know, 1500 years, roughly speaking, the Roman Catholic Church was the only ballgame in Western Europe. You were either Roman Catholic or you were a pagan, an infidel, a heretic, whatever, and likely firing wood to be burned at the stake.
Yes.
So that changed in two different empires for oddly similar reasons, but at very different times in history. The first was in Spain, which was, we tend to forget today, once a great world power. I mean, we're living in what was once New Spain here. And when, during the era of the Inquisition and the era following the Fourth Lateran Council and following all the Crusades, there was tremendous pressure on Jews in Spain to convert or die. Many Jews converted, and the Spanish eventually began to question the sincerity of those conversions. And the community was referred to as the conversos, those who had converted, or new Christians. And these new Christians did extraordinarily well. They succeeded so much in terms of the society that they were now allowed to enter freely as Catholics, that they became bishops and cardinals and ministers of government and professors of universities and even rectors of universities. And the Catholics around them began to be alarmed by the extraordinarily high percentage of these so-called new Christians who were stealing jobs from them. And basically, the reaction to that economic and social and professional success of the new Christians, i.e. recently converted Jews, and maybe by recently converted, I don't mean last week, maybe one or two or even three generations, was to pass a series of laws known as limpieza de sangre, which basically prohibited Jews from holding public office,
purity
from
of
holding
blood,
right? High church office, whatever. Mm-hmm. And a new form of anti-Semitism was invented in which being Jewish was something in your blood that you couldn't get rid of. You couldn't modify by conversion. You couldn't modify by believing or practicing different religious things. You were stuck with it. And this stuck around till the time of the Nazis. And where the Nazis ultimately came from was the parallel success of Jews in the late 19th century in big places in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, like Vienna, Prague, Berlin, Budapest, whatever.
And yes. Maybe we can continue that thought next week.
Okay, look forward to it.
Thanks, Tom. We welcome our Mivinah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
The latest wave of Palestinian Arab terrorism is somehow different from the others that have happened. Israelis have had plenty of experience of being attacked as civilians with bombs with explosives strapped around people with guns. This is something different.
Yeah, one can say that, you know, we didn't have too many wars. We had one war that started in 1948, and we're still in the same war. We're still fighting for our independence. But the uniqueness of this wave of terror is that it's like by individuals, not organized terror. So you can't predict it. No one can tell. No one knows that someone decided to take a knife and he will go to the market today. So there is no intelligence help. And like someone just can decide on his way to the school to take his scissors from his backpack and just stab someone. Just I know it sounds like crazy, but that's how crazy the situation is in Israel. And that's why if you will go now in Israel, you will see that the Israelis that usually are very, very connected to their cell phones. That's what I saw that recently, that mainly in Jerusalem, that people are no longer like with their cell phones and
walking,
they are more
aware of what's around them.
Yeah, more aware. So this is the good part of that. But again, it's a very unique because you can do nothing. And that's the helpless feeling of Israelis, that the big and amazing army we have, the very progress intelligence services that we have, they can't predict it. They just can't, because people just being brainwashed for, you know, years and years. And then one day they decide that they will do it. And they are not going to tell their mom and dad, you know, this morning, don't expect me for lunch, I'm going to stab someone. So when you don't share this information with no one, so there is no way to
predict it, there's no way to control it.
And I think that's the major uniqueness, because all the other intifadas and all the other uprisings were organized by Fatah, by Hamas, by this, by that. But now, like, there is no one organization, there is like thousands of individuals that just want to stab Israeli. That's it.
You know, in a way, the other intifadas were much more devastating to the economy. They caused huge problems. They killed far more people. They wounded far more people. They caused much greater emergency services disruption. But this is an insidious thing. It kind of gets into people's mentality and changes how they think.
This is real terror, because people are really afraid.
You know, Jack the Ripper scared far more people than all the people who were being killed all the time by trolleys going offline, by all kinds of other murders. But something like this is really disturbing. Well, we hope that it ends soon and that some resolution can come in a positive way.
Amen.
Thanks, Oshrat. We'll talk next week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John, good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So you guys have a big event coming up on Sunday, April 3rd.
We are so pumped up. It's our second STEM festival, and we started this last year. We had like 800 people turn out for this thing.
Wow.
So it's become the premier STEM festival in Tucson. And so proud to host it right at the Tucson Hebrew Academy.
Okay, so what's a STEM festival?
That's a good question. STEM is an acronym, stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. Sometimes people insert an A for art and call it STEAM, but we're doing it as STEM. And it's essentially where all the learning, all the applications of mathematics and science and design and engineering come together. You know, when you build a space shuttle, or you build an Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum. There's so much that goes into it, and it's really the product, it's the output of all that learning and all those sciences that come together. So at the STEM Festival, for example, we're going to have a whole range of vendors. Over 30 vendors in the science and engineering and mathematics community will be out. We're going to have live animals. There'll be things like brains and organs that you can actually get your hands on if you're feeling it.
Ooh.
We're going to have a display from the University of Arizona, who are putting together a new mission to go land on a comet and do research. So they're going to have a mock-up of that.
Mars wasn't enough. Now it's
Mars wasn't enough. That's right. We're going to have traditional stuff like solar cooking and things you can do to make music with sound. There will be live animals present. There'll be insect collections. There'll be all kinds of experiments that kids can do. How many pennies can you float on a piece of aluminum foil? So there's just a huge amount of hands-on, high-engaging activities at this massive event.
What a great experience for everybody. And, you know, you can say, well, what does this have to do with your Jewish education? Well, it's all education.
It's all education. And, you know, we have, as Jews, the capacity to boast that so many Jewish people are Nobel Prize winners and have had made, you know,
24% at the last.
Isn't that amazing? And great discoveries in science and medicine. And
physics, every area of science.
Absolutely.
Right?
So it's a great way to celebrate and expose kids to science and learning. It's open to the whole community, and it's hosted at THA.
And is there a charge to come?
It is free.
Free, and there'll be parking somewhere for sure.
There's parking all around. Also, there'll be some food sales if you're hungry.
And what time does it start on April 3rd, Sunday, April 3rd?
The program runs from 10 to 2.
Learning is just as Jewish as it gets. Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
Thank you, and we'll look for you at the STEM Festival.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, THAAZ.org, 529-3888.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. A young Jewish guy walks into the lingerie department of Macy's in New York and tells the sales lady, "I'd like a Jewish bra for my wife. She's size 34B. With a quizzical look, the sales lady asks, "What kind of bra?" He repeats, a Jewish bra. She said to tell you she wanted a Jewish bra and you would know what she wanted. "Oh, now I remember," said the sales lady. "We don't get as many requests for them as we used to. Most of our customers lately want the Catholic bra, the Salvation Army bra, the Presbyterian bra." Confused and a little flustered, the man asks, "So what's the difference?" The sales lady responds, "Oh, it's really quite simple. The Catholic bra supports the masses. The Salvation Army bra lifts up the fallen. And the Presbyterian bra keeps them staunch and upright." He muses on that information and says, "I know I'm going to regret this, but what does the Jewish bra do?" Ah, the Jewish bra, the sales lady replies. It makes mountains out of molehills. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish Just for You. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion is Shmini. It includes a very dramatic and traumatic event. The tabernacle in the wilderness has just been consecrated, and the priests, Moses' brother Aaron and his sons, are entering into their office. The Shekhinah, God's presence, fills the tabernacle, and all is well with the people of Israel. Then suddenly disaster strikes. Aaron's eldest sons, newly ordained priests named Nadav and Avihu, offer what is called Esh Zarah, a strange fire, to the Lord. They are immediately struck down and devoured by a flame, dying before God. In the aftermath of this tragedy, Moses consoles Aaron with strange words. He tells him, God says, Bikrovai Ekadesh, by those brought near to me I am consecrated and honored before the people. There's no word on whether Aaron accepted this as somehow a just ending for his sons. The text merely says, Vayidom Aharon. Aaron was silent. We don't know the young priest's offense, if there was one. We are not told what that strange fire was. God decrees, atonement offerings are made for whatever sin Nadav and Avihu have committed, and the people are restored to God's favor. Calamity occurs, and we go on. We also do not know in our own lives why certain tragedies take place or why terrible things sometimes happen to good people. As Ben Sirach says in the text Ecclesiasticus from the Apocrypha of the Hebrew Bible, we have been shown more than we can understand. But we do know that silence, like Aaron's, may be the only real response to profound tragedy and personal loss. Words are usually offered, but it's not typically the specific words that bring healing. It is the effort to be present and console that matters most. At these times, our comfort may come only when we silently acknowledge our powerlessness. This may seem small comfort indeed, but it is also an honest appraisal of our inability to fully comprehend profound loss. May God keep us from tragedy. But may God also give us the strength of Aaron when we have to face it, the ability to accept the painful inadequacy of our own explanations with dignity and courage. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, legendary AP reporter Mort Rosenblum, will explain what it means to be a reporter, what's bad and what's good about the people who report the news today and how it's transmitted. Find it all out when we return here on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998 and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
While Islamist terror attacks in Belgium horrified the world last week, they were not the only Muslim terror murders in the past 7 days. Three Israelis were killed by a homicide-suicide bomber in Istanbul, Turkey, last weekend. The Muslim terrorist followed a group of Israeli tourists from their hotel for several kilometers, waited outside a restaurant for them to eat breakfast, and then blew himself up when they emerged, killing the three Israelis and one other tourist. Turkish news outlets from across the political spectrum carried head-and-shoulders photos of three other suspected ISIS members who had been given orders to carry out further attacks in crowded areas, primarily Istanbul. In a covert operation organized by the Jewish Agency, 19 of Yemen's last Jews were brought to Israel last week. The operation was carried out in coordination with Israel's foreign ministry, the U.S. State Department, and other governmental bodies, and it concludes an extended period of organized immigration from Yemen to Israel that began in 1949. Over the past few years, as the civil war in Yemen has intensified and threatened its tiny Jewish community, about 200 Yemenite Jews have been airlifted secretly to Israel. This last group included a rabbi carrying a 500-year-old Torah, the last one in use in Yemen. This is a highly significant moment in the history of Israel and of Aliyah, Jewish Agency Chairman Natan Sharansky said. From Operation Magic Carpet back in 1949 until the present day, the Jewish Agency has helped bring Yemenite Jewry home to Israel. Today we bring that historic mission to a close. More than 51,000 Yemenite Jews have immigrated to Israel since the state was created in 1948. The majority of the community, nearly 50,000 individuals, were brought in 1949 and 1950. Last week's operation was carried out in secret because of the unstable security situation in Yemen, growing anti-Semitism and hostility against Jews, and logistical difficulties. The Yemenite Jewish community dated back to the second, maybe even first Temple times, well over 2,000 years ago. In other news, in Argentina, the Buenos Aires Criminal Appeals Court ruled the investigation into the shooting death of the Amia Jewish Center terrorist massacre special prosecutor Alberto Nisman should be moved to a federal court. In Argentina, federal courts handle political murder cases. It's plausible to assume that the death of Alberto Natalio Nisman could also be the result of the activity of a third party, two of the three judges wrote. During the hearing, Nisman's ex-wife, Sandra Arroyo Salgado, a former federal judge herself, cried when she said Nisman's death was the most serious institutional event to affect Argentina since the return of democracy. One of her lawyers read the threats emailed to Nisman in the weeks before his death aloud. "We will make true our promise to kill you and your family, but before that we will make you look like crud in public and in the media," one message said. "We've already managed to separate you from the Amia case, and we've gotten Argentina a deal with Iran without you." An attorney for Nisman's mother, Sarah Garfinkel, asked the court to send the Nisman case to the federal court for murder trial. Nisman was assassinated to impede the progress of his work on behalf of the state. This case is screaming for a transfer to the federal courts because it must be recognized that Nisman was murdered. Nisman was found dead in his Buenos Aires apartment in January 2015, just hours before he was going to present evidence to Argentine lawmakers that President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner covered up Iran's role in the Amia Jewish Center bombing of 1994, which murdered 85 and left hundreds wounded. No official cause of death has yet been given for Nisman. Earlier this month, a city court judge, Fabiano Pomagini, ordered the venue changed to a federal court just 10 hours after a former Argentine spymaster accused the Kirchner government of being responsible for Nisman's death. Diego Lagomarsino, an employee in the Buenos Aires prosecutor's office, acknowledged that he had lent a very old .22 caliber pistol to Nisman, which was used in his death. Now, perhaps, we will find out if Nisman was murdered at President Kirchner's orders, and perhaps, also, just how complicit the Argentinian government was in the Amiya attack by Iran back in 1994. Andrew Grove, the Holocaust survivor whose dictatorial management technique helped Intel Corporation drive the semiconductor revolution, died this last week at age 79. Grove was born Andras Grof, September 2, 1936, in a middle-class Jewish household in Budapest. His father was rounded up by German troops occupying Hungary during World War II and sent to a labor camp where he survived typhoid and pneumonia. The young Andrew Grove and his mother were hidden by a Christian family until the end of World War II. Grove recalled that at age 8 he was told by his mother to assume a Christian alias. She explained to me that I cannot make a mistake, that I had to forget my name. Liberation from the Nazis was followed by communism in Hungary, and then the Budapest Uprising of 1956 was brutally put down by Russian tanks. Andrew Grove fled Hungary after his fellow students were arrested, crossed the border into Austria after a night spent evading Soviet troops, and later boarded a refugee ship to New York. From there, he was taken to a former POW camp in New Jersey until finally his immigration papers came through. After learning English, graduating from CCNY, and getting his doctorate from Berkeley, Andrew Grove worked at Fairchild Semiconductor, and in 1968 joined Intel, a new semiconductor manufacturer that emerged as the leader of Silicon Valley, helping give the valley its name. By the early 1980s, personal computers were widespread phenomena, and Intel microprocessors powered more than 80% of these machines. In partnership with Microsoft, led by Bill Gates, Andrew Grove, the Hungarian Jew and child survivor of the Holocaust, helped Intel take over the computer world. May his memory be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Martin Rosenblum, was a reporter for the Associated Press, the AP for, a generation or so.
Several generations.
Maybe several or eight. Really. Seven or eight generations.
It was almost
Has covered
40 years.
Major stories all over the world for the AP. Teaches journalism now, and we were talking about some of the changes in the media in recent years. As a journalist, when you report a story, you report any differently now than you did?
Well, I mean, the whole definition has changed a lot. I mean, I much prefer the term reporter to journalist because, I mean, you know, I've got this term I use when I call karaoke journalism. I mean, these days anybody can step up to the mic and you don't really have to know the words. You know, and if you got a good voice, then you got a big audience, but you really can mislead a lot of people. A reporter actually goes out to where the news is and actually looks at real sources and real facts and, you know, reports it firsthand. There's a vast difference between that and sitting back comfortably somewhere and guessing about distant news.
You know, one of the challenges I think today is the way that the news cycle has become, first of all, 24-hour cycle, second of all, accessible to everybody on their phone. Those stories can be in depth, but mostly they're not. It's almost like seeing the news through a crawl.
Well, you know, it's the New York Times, which is unfortunately the only real newspaper left, possibly the Washington Post, but is now a daily magazine. In fact, as it was really explained to me by some Times Insiders friends, because it's, as you say, it's 24 hours. I mean, you read the New York Times. Most people read the New York Times on their smartphones on the move, and you don't really read a newspaper that way. When I teach, I have a short 2-month course for international reporting at the university, and the textbook we use is the daily print copy of the New York Times, because and I might have to change that, because according to the old tradition, what happened is there would be a bunch of editors would sit together at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and decide things and what's important and why it's important, and it's not so much what people thought they wanted to know, but what people really should know that's important. And they would lay out the paper in that way. And so you would learn things you didn't know you wanted to know. And these days, it's kind of have it your way news, where you focus on what you think you want to know, and then you get distracted off into something else. And so we have no real font of knowledge, of shared wisdom, and we don't know anything.
One of the challenges for the way that news is reported today is you get a perception of a place or a country and you don't get any depth. And so, for example, when I lead a trip to Israel, people say, oh, isn't there terrorism? Are things blowing up all the time? And, you know, you'll spend months in the country and never have any idea of anything happening except if you saw a TV screen. Is that always a consequence of the reporting?
I mean, you know, people, we've always, I remember when I was running the Herald Tribune in Paris, and I got a call from some newspaper publisher in Miami, and I was in Miami, it was a place in Florida, and you know, he said, oh, I just saw this story, is it safe for me to come to Paris? And the story was about, no, sorry, I mean, is it safe for me to go to Rome? And the story was about some fight in Milan between two political guys, and they'd shot each other or something, I don't know what it was. And I said, look, if there's a bar fight in the Bronx, are you going to tell somebody not to go to Miami? You know, you know, it's insane how people... And that's why this gets back to your original question. That's why this is a serious job, this business of being a reporter. You really kind of have to know how to assess things, because you can't just do just the facts, ma'am, you know, on the one hand this, on the other hand that. That's how we got to global warming. That's how we got to all these problems, is false equivalents. You have to have a reporter who's smart, we're not necessarily smart, but who at least works hard enough to see the various elements, you know, make a judgment not based on what he or she feels, but what the results show, and lead the reader, but yet giving enough information to be able to let the reader make up, you know, his or her mind. This is not easy.
Is there still room for serious investigative journalism, serious reporting? I think of the Boston Globe story that was made in the movie Spotlight, which won the Oscar not too long ago. That's pretty good journalism. That's pretty good reporting, isn't it?
That was wonderful reporting. And yes, there is still room for that. But the problem is, you know, we're kind of obsessed with these prizes. And I mean, I look at these things, you know, investigative series, you know, I mean, it was just one close to home. And I'm just thinking, oh God, another guy's after a prize, you know, and you know, these stories are reported with prizes in mind, and they go after it, and they, you know, push it really hard and stuff. So yes, a really good, solid investigative report that really gets somewhere, like, oh, I'm thinking, for example, Dana Priest thing a while ago on the veterans hospitals, you know, and Walter right. Reed in the veterans hospital in the Washington Post. I mean, or same reporter who exposed how many people have top level security clearance, you know, more than a million, and are able to snoop on us, you know, in the pay of the government. Those are really solid investigative stories, and they're really important. And yeah, there's a place for them.
There's a term that you mentioned before we came on the air that reporters use, or people doing stories, if they're the reporters or not, called the get.
Yeah, the get. I don't use that term, but
you
know, I mean, I hate the
term. Judaism means a divorce.
No, that's why I brought it up, because right. what that means is
it's kind of the opposite of a divorce, actually.
It just means that a reporter is able to get somebody to sit down. And when you do it that way, you're really essentially accepting conditions, even if they're implied. And so you know, you're tossing puffballs. I mean, you can't really get to you can't really reach the crux of what you want to know from the person. It's really about you. It's not about the reader or the viewer.
This is not a phenomenon reserved for minor figures. Hillary Clinton is kind of famous for this, right?
Right. I mean, there was something that just came out that somebody admitted that happened years ago, that her people insisted on conditions. You don't ask her about this. You don't ask her about this. You say this. I mean, that's outrageous.
Yeah, it's kind of not exactly what we would call reporting, is it?
No, it really isn't.
So where should people go if they want to know what's really going on?
Oh, no, that's a real problem. I mean, that's a real problem. I mean, really, these days, a person who wants to be informed has to do as much work as a reporter himself or herself does. I mean, you've got to really look at it. First, you've got to knock out the obvious bias stuff on both sides. I mean, flip off Fox, for example. That's, you know, that's a pretty good start.
Fair and balanced. I always thought if you have to say it.
Yeah, really.
I mean, just like saying one of the great newspapers of the world, if you have to tell people that, you aren't.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, they've made a mockery of that. I mean, you know, balanced, it's pretty hard to be balanced, because if balance is, you know, if it's, you get false balance. I mean, you know, that's how we got global warming. We have 3,000 experts from all around the world with actually real data telling us what's going on, and we get some crazy weatherman in New Orleans who says, I don't think so, and he gets equal space, you know. But fair is the key. I mean, you know, you can be fair. You know, you've got to be fair. And there's a big thing going on in journalism. Now, Glenn Greenwald, for example, gets a lot of ink and a lot of space. And his thing is, well, no, a journalist has got to be an advocate because, well, that's his thing. That's where he comes from. But I totally disagree. I mean, of course you can be objective. You know, you have to really know what your prejudices are, and every human has them, and allow for them. And it's not perfect, but, you know, you've got judges and they're not perfect, but you can try.
What was the most challenging story you ever covered?
I think it was probably Argentina, because I broke those first stories about the death squads and the dirty war, and all of it. There were very few of us down there at the time, and we were all on about 6 or 7 death lists that we knew about. So it's one thing to be, you know, in a war, I mean, you can kind of pretty much calculate, you know, where it's coming from and from whom, you know, and what, you know, and take your measures. But, you know, when somebody can be targeting you, that's pretty scary. And, you know, I don't go out as much as I used to. In fact, you know, I'm relatively careful now. I'm an old dude, you know, and I've done a lot of it. But you know, these young guys that I mean, men and women, it's extremely dangerous for them now because back when we were on the road, I mean, it was, you weren't really a target. I mean, if you got into trouble, it was just bad luck or bad judgment. But these days, I mean, look at Jim Foley. I mean, a really wonderful reporter for Global Post. And he was earning nothing and he was having to save money by, you know, hitching rides with rebels and stuff, which was never really a good idea. And he got captured, you know, and beheaded on camera. And his very, very noble parents said, look, don't let this stop you. This was Jim's goal in life and his dream. And we have to know what's going on in the world. And young people have to get out there. You know, and they're right, the Foleys. We really need to know what's going on in the world. But this means that all the rest of us have got to support these people. We got to pay them. We got to support them. We have to recognize them. And we have to demand quality from the news organizations in which their work appears.
Who was your favorite political figure that you ever covered?
My favorite political figure? That's a really good question. Nelson Mandela, maybe. I mean, it's hard to really say for different reasons, but can't really think of one in America. I mean, I think he's a pretty
a little disappointing.
Yeah, I can think he's a pretty good qualities. I mean, obviously Kennedy for certain reasons, but, you know, Kennedy was the Vietnam War, you know, I mean, he, however noble, you know, he's the guy that got us involved in that, you know,
and very heavily,
yeah. And, I liked Bill Clinton a lot, but quite frankly, he was probably the worst foreign policy president we ever had. I mean, for lots of reasons, for not paying attention to Russia when it fell apart, for not acting soon enough in Bosnia, for pulling us out of Africa during that in Somalia and letting Rwanda happen, for which at least he had the good grace to apologize. But I think the lesson here is foreign policy and running the world is a very complicated job with real nuances. And I look at these bozos, you know, in the Republican Party that are presenting themselves as experts in this. It just scares the hell out of me.
When you have a really interesting website, and I don't know how often you keep it up, this little bunch of madmen about really interesting journalist issues around the world.
Right. Yeah. A little bunch of madmen. I've kind of stopped it. That was to support a book I wrote. I wrote a little book that started to be a handbook for my students, and then it got to be kind of a general underground classic. But it comes from a phrase from an old reporter named H.R. Knickerbocker in the, I guess, the 30s.
Which is really a fantastic name.
Yeah. Great name and a great quote. He says, you know, whenever you see hundreds of thousands of sane people struggling to get out of a place and a little bunch of madmen trying to get in, you know, the latter are newspaper men. And of course, not women also, but that's still kind of the case, you know. I mean, some of the places that we've kind of struggled to get in have been pretty crazy.
I want to thank Mort Rosenbloom for a great visit. I feel like we could do this often. Mort, thanks so much.
No problem. I just want to just add at the end, I mean, what I do now is I've got something called Reporting Unlimited. It's fairly active on Facebook. I'm about to go online with it, and that's going to try to get some real reporting going. I'm getting together some people that really know what they're doing, and that could be fun. Reporting Unlimited.
And holding up the torch of real reporting.
Well, you know, at least trying to do something about it.
Doing the best. Thanks so much, Mort.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Ori Kam, the outstanding violist of the magnificent Jerusalem Quartet. Our playout this morning comes from a slightly ridiculous preview of Passover music. It's from the a cappella group 613 doing their parody of Let It Go called Chosen. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov and a week, we pray, of peace.
The Nile ran fast through the desert that night, but the water, it was red. The kingdom was full of locusts, with frogs jumping in their beds. The Jews were slaving, building Ramses and Pito.